Lights, models, guest list. Just do your best, darling.
This time next year, we'll be millionaires.
You said that this time last year.
Are you eating, ain't you?
Nooba, yerba, nooba. Yeah, because I was just about to do it if you had we had. God, this is too unfair. Ain't I never even ate nothing or nothing.
Anyway, happy Valentine's Day. How are you?
Oh, I'm a bit tired. I need my beauty sleep.
Oh, you don't need beauty sleep? Well, 40 winks.
God, I can't stand it anymore. All anyone ever does is look at me all day in here. Stop looking at me. Stop looking at me. I can't bear it. I just see putrid stench of disinfectant. I've got to go. I've got to get out.
Well, why don't you just go home?
Would you mind if I just left?
Another time. It is nice to see.
Hello, I'm David Mitchell, and you're listening to the final part of Radio 2's History of British Comedy. And you join us as we reach the 1980s.
All right. Do you have a knife?
Yeah.
Good, because I wish to quickly send off some party invitations, and to make them look particularly tough, I wish to write them in blood. Your blood, to be precise.
How much blood will you actually be requiring, my lord?
Oh, nothing much. Just a small puddle.
Will you be wanting me to cut anything off? An arm or a leg, for instance?
Oh, good lord, no. A little prick should do.
1970s escapism would soon give way to 1980s cynicism. The route went via an exuberant, surreal performer who did everything in the best possible taste.
I guess I'll puke here.
As with every new generation, there were people like Kenny Everett who wanted to do things differently. Kenny started out as a radio DJ rather than a stand-up comedy performer, but his wit shone through and he soon moved to television.
Kenny Everett was the only non-comedian I ever wrote for.
Barry Cryer.
Philip Jones at Thames Television years ago said to his son, who was then 18, who's not on television now, you think should be? And his son said, Kenny Everett. So I'd met Kenny through other things before, and I was invited to a lunch with Kenny, and we talked and talked. Kenny had no preconceived idea of this is what I do. A lot of the great comics said, yeah, this is funny, but it's not me. Everett never said this isn't me. His reaction was, what am I going to do with this? He had an instinct.
Anyway, here's the joke. Punk, Dan and Nick for a routine inquiry. Know what I mean? Conversation sounds like this. This is the copper speaking. All right, laddie. Who done a pub over last night? Was it your lot? Landlord says he saw you down there. And stop hitting me when I'm talking to you.
I can't get away from boring people. I'm always getting stuck on landings with couples who've done their own conveyancing.
It's Victoria Wood back again with all her friends.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Do it while the mood is right. I'm feeling appealing. I've really got an appetite. I'm on fire with desire. I can handle half the tenors in a male voice choir. Let's do it. Let's do it tonight.
The roots of that sort of comedy song go straight back to the Victorian music halls, a style for which we've never quite lost our taste. And like those early music hall performers, it wasn't long before Victoria Wood moved on to stand-up.
I can remember when pants were pants. You wore them for 20 years, then you cut them down for pant scrubs. Oh, quilts. We used to make lovely quilts out of Celanese bloomers. Every gusset a memory. Not bras, though, they won't lie flat, you see. We weren't having hysterectomies every 2 minutes either, like the girls these days. If something went wrong down below, you kept your gob shut and turned up the wireless.
Took me a few years to progress to standing up. You know, after a few years, I got so I could have just a radio mic and nothing in my hands and no piano and nothing. And then I felt I'd reached, you know, achieved something to make it that simple. I mean, I do base it in truth, and I do try and be honest in a sense. I try and come from a point of view of reality, but, you know, in the end, it is 2 hours of lies.
Kenny Everett and Victoria Wood are two examples of 1980s new comedy that was embraced by the mainstream. Meanwhile, coming up through an underground circuit of live clubs was the trend that came to be known as alternative comedy. But Ben Elton was by no means the first.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Max Spice!
Observational comedy was at the heart of the 1980s alternative movement, but it didn't begin there. It was being done, for example, in the folk clubs of the 1970s by an Englishman, a Welshman and a Scotsman, Carrot, Boyce and Connolly.
There's a theory that we went from the comedians, Frank Carson, all those, you know.
Comedian Dave Spikey.
Went from there to alternative. So all of a sudden it's Saturday Night Live, it's Ben Elton, it's Alexis Hale, it's whatever. And it's not. There was that middle area, wasn't there? The crossover period where we have what I like to call the folk club comedians. And every region seemed to have one. The daddy of them all was Billy Connolly. Then Wales had Max Boyce, who I was lucky to tour with a few times. And the Midlands had Jasper Kerrer. And a lot of all those slightly lesser-known names. And it was like an eye-opener because they were just going on stage and talking about their lives. And I thought, this is just brilliant. This is exactly what I'd like to do, you know.
I think it's comedy is a little bit like, say, rock music, in the fact that when Elvis Presley came along, suddenly it just smashed into a whole new area of music.
Jasper Carrot, speaking at the height of the 80s boom.
And I think comedy up until about the mid-70s was very much sort of bow tie, mother-in-law jokes, 10 minutes on the Cilla Black show. And your choice of comedy was very limited. It was very sort of middle of the road and very strictured. And suddenly the bands were broken out. And what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years is that those early bands have been, you know, people have suddenly realised that you don't have to do one-liners, that you can talk about social observation and social comment. And I think that's why it's come about. There is now more choice, and people can actually choose the area of comedy that they like.
I bought a house out in the country about a couple of years ago, and I inherited this mole, right? And, like, well, being Birmingham born and bred, you know, well, you don't come across a lot of moles in Birmingham, to be honest. Like, found a mole in Birmingham, they'd eat it. You know? And then we bought this house, like, and this mole has driven me mental. I tell you, like, if ever I cup hold of it, I'll bury it alive. I tell you.
The conversational approach to comedy is still in evidence to this day. Comedian and actor Alan Davis.
What a lot of comedians, my peers and contemporaries, do is talk about their own lives and tend to tell true stories about people they've actually known. They're embellished, or one story blends with another to create something that's a piece of comedy. Rather than nonsense stories, which kind of start with a punchline and then you work your way back to create something. So a lot of the comedy, the old jokes, the old gags, are quite surreal when you break them down. But at the same time, there were people that I really admired and still do admire who were contemporaries of mine on the comedy circuit, like Harry Hill and Reeves and Mortimer, who created a bit crazy world that was impenetrable to the audience. I remember Harry Hill being heckled once. Was pointless heckling Harry Hill because he didn't engage with you. And then he said to the heckler, "You heckle me now, but I am safe in the knowledge that I have a chicken in the oven at home." And that
it wasn't just about a new approach, of course. The content was also changing.
What? What about Cliff Richard?
You're trying to be funny. Because if you are, I think it's in pretty poor taste. That's all. I'm not a fridge, you know.
Often described as a backlash against some of the racist, sexist comedy of the 1970s, alternative comedy is forever linked to the loads of money 1980s and the Thatcher years. A new wave of performers in a new wave of venues propose themselves as an alternative to the mainstream. The movement wanted to challenge what were acceptable subjects for comedy. There were complaints about excessive political correctness, but it wasn't introduced without reason.
At the time, comedy tended to be brutalisation, tended to be taking the mick out of minorities. People are much more reluctant to do that now.
80s comedy icon Ben Elton.
So when people sneer at political correctness or things, just let them remember the amount of ground that's been covered. For instance, one of the big things I was knocked for was not presuming on the sexuality of the audience. So I would sometimes say, you know, the straight women in the audience will know what I mean if I'm talking about having it off with a man or something, or the gays will know what I mean. Now, this was seen as outrageous piety by some journalists. It wasn't piety. It was a simple reaction that I'd had from, I remember at university seeing a badge, which I thought was terribly clever. A woman was wearing it. How dare you presume I'm a heterosexual? Now, in 79, that was interesting. I mean, these days, I think it would be unnecessary. We've all moved on. It would actually look pious now and rather divisive. But then, before anyone had even thought, hey, hang on a minute, yes, she might well not be a heterosexual. You know, these were interesting thoughts that moved us all on. And they certainly affected me.
I was around there as almost part of it.
Media lecturer Dr. C.P. Lee.
And watching in Manchester the group 20th Century Coyote emerge, which had Rick Mayall, Abe Edmondson, Ben Elton, and a couple of other sundries from that, doing stand-up improv nights at Band on the Wall, but creating a new comedy. It was good comedy. But they weren't going to get on TV, and they weren't going to go and work in the working men's clubs.
I suppose now, when it's 30 years on, you get some historical perspective on alternative comedy. It felt important at the time. I think that's the key thing. It really felt what was happening in the clubs felt very, very different from everything that you would see on the television or hear on the radio. And it did feel like a different entity. It's gone now, that. It's disappeared. It's been watered down and diluted away, and you can take comedians from the London Comedy Circuit and put them straight on television. That happens all the time.
The roots of the alternative scene can probably be traced back to the opening of the Comedy Store in 1979, the first of many comedy clubs that would give new opportunities to aspiring performers. Anyone who wanted to could have a go. This was comedy's answer to punk rock. Co-founder Don Ward had visited comedy clubs in America, and he wanted to bring the same concept to the UK.
I thought, well, if it can happen in America, surely such a thing can happen over here. So I put adverts in various magazines, Builders Weekly, The Jewish Chronicle, Punch, various publications. And said, well, are you a frustrated comedian, but you haven't had the break? And then come along to the Comedy Store in Dean Street, Soho, and audition, and we will put you on stage and invite the heads of media and see if we can make you a star. And I got 150 people queued up outside to come into the club. But the first one I auditioned was Alexi Sale. And I thought, yes, I've got my compere. People like Rick Mayall, Abe Edmondson came along, Nigel Planer, Peter Richardson, French and Saunders. So these are now, you know, big established acts. But here they were in the very early days, raw amateur talent.
Who is it?
It's me!
Who?
It's me, Dawn French, your comedy partner!
Well, come in then.
Dawn and I used to get props. We used to find a prop and find something funny to do with it. It was kind of fairly basic stuff. Initially, you see, we were under the illusion that we had to change our act every night because we thought, well, people have seen it now. You know, there might only be 10 of them, but they've seen it, and we thought we had to think up something new. So the material will thin very, very quickly. And then we developed the French and Saunders persona.
The pioneers of the alternative movement wanted to address the gender and ethnic imbalance of the British comedy scene, with the result that, where it had once been entirely dominated by white men, it was now only mostly dominated by white men. Back in the 70s, comedian Charlie Williams had seemed to be the only black face on the comedy scene.
Yeah, Charlie Williams on the comedians, he really was a breakthrough, I suppose, for black comics.
Producer of The Comedians, Johnny Hamp.
There weren't many around at that time. There was Josh White, who was also on the Comedians. But Charlie had that great appeal because he had this very broad Yorkshire accent. And I think that was what made him particularly funny. But, of course, it was a breakthrough for black comics. But I think if he'd been white, it'd have been funny. I mean, with that sort of delivery, it was great. Of course, Lenny Henry was next, I suppose. I mean, there weren't any Asian comedians around. I'd love to have had some Asian comedians because, I mean, we had Scots and Irish and Londoners and Southerners and West Country people, you know. If I'd found a German who was funny, I'd have put him in.
To this day, comedy fails perfectly to reflect the makeup of Britain, but things were at least moving in the right direction.
Oh, I'm totally off my face. How come every Friday night we end up in the Burnie Inn?
Because that's what you do, innit? You go out, you get tanked up on lassies, and you go for an English.
We got a big mix of people in this country.
Comedy Store founder Don Ward.
And they have come forward as far as comedy is concerned. So, you know, we have on our books a young man called Imran Yusuf, who's destined to be a big star, who is Indian and born in Kenya. There is Paul Chowdhury, there is Shappi Korshandi, there's Shazia Mirza.
Throughout our story, we've covered how the medium is as important as the material in driving change. British comedy developed as music hall became variety, before moving on to radio and then on to TV. The arrival of BBC Two had shaken things up in 1964, and a huge shot in the arm came with the launch of the nation's fourth TV channel in 1982. Channel 4, and S4C in Wales, offered an opportunity to be different, and different meant embracing the new. Two early Channel 4 series had a major influence on the genre. The American-influenced Friday Night and later Saturday Live were so edgy that compere Ben Elton had to perform his set in front of a solicitor before he was allowed to go live.
What I was doing in the 80s on Saturday Live and Friday Live as a live comedian was doing the job that a live comedian, particularly a young one on Channel 4, damn well ought to do, which is looking at the powers that be and having a go. Having a go, though, based on principle. I believe satire without principle is a blunt sword indeed. If you just take the mick out of someone's long upper lip or glasses or whatever, or you say, well, I've had a go at the Tories, I'd better have a go at Labour, that's pointless.
And if Friday and Saturday Live were Channel 4's answer to traditional light entertainment shows, then The Comic Strip Presents was their answer to the traditional sitcom. The Comic Strip concept began life as a comedy club, set up by Comedy Store regulars.
Yes, so Michael White came along and offered them the opportunity, the money, the finance, to come out of the Boulevard Theatre.
Don Ward, co-founder of the Comedy Store.
To come out of there and they made these films and pieces for television. So Michael White was the knight in white armour, you might say, that kicked comedy off in a different direction, but made more people aware of it. One would say that by doing what they did, that launched them off into television and film.
The Comic Strip Presents would launch many careers, including Britain's first mainstream female double act since Gert and Daisy, Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders.
You've only got 1 minute left.
Okay, a luxury ladies and gents car coat.
Yes.
A cuddly toy. You put music in it. It does music. Gramophone.
Yes.
A cuddly toy, I've said that.
Yes.
Oh, 2 tickets for Phantom of the Opera.
Good.
A kiddish pencil case.
Yes.
Set. Torch
drinking,
set.
Drinking.
Champagne.
What about the dogs?
Dog leashes and baskets.
Yes.
Cuddly toy. I said, weekend break to the Isle of Man.
Yes.
The towel set.
Cleaning up. You'll need to clean up.
Dustbuster.
Hurry!
Don't. Ice cream maker.
Yes.
Cuddly toy.
That's it. That's the deadline. That is your Christmas list for this year.
All right.
This fourth channel went on to produce some of Britain's greatest comedies, everything from Father Ted and Black Books to Brass Eye and Phoenix Nights. But the new channel did not have a monopoly on novelty. Not to be outdone by this young upstart, the BBC scheduled a very contemporary sitcom.
Once in every lifetime comes a love like this. Oh, I need you, you need me. Oh, my darling, can't you see? Young ones, darling, with a young one.
Oh, that's my flatmate, Vivian. Hi, Vivian, what are you doing?
Shut up, you girl!
It's incredible! I'm not a girl at all! Mind you, we're all pretty potty in this house. Last night, right, we were all watching the television, and it was a programme we wanted to watch, you know, and we were just watching it, and right in the middle of it, I got up and turned it off! Mad!
Featuring many of the performers who are about to be the faces of Channel 4, this series became required viewing for Britain's youth audience. Like The Goon Show and Monty Python before it, The Young Ones proved that, just as with music, no one wants to be into the same stuff as their parents are. Material like...
I understand you're going to sing for us, Mr. Grimley.
Oh, my word, yes. It's a little song about Samuel Pepys.
Oh, yes, he was a great lexicographer.
Well, he had ample opportunity, didn't he? Wasn't writing his diary all the time, was he?
Quite so.
Righto, group. Thanks out.
A shy young maid has took a room down at the village inn. Her bedside light is oh so bright and the curtains oh so thin. She enters a room at 9 o'clock, at 9:30 she sleeps. Lord Clarendon walks quickly on, but naughty Samuel peeps. Oh, we know
it's right. ITV stalwart Benny Hill had been at the top of the comedy tree since his BBC debut in the 1950s. His influence was undoubtedly huge, but his style would fall out of favour in the 1980s.
I think there's a dual standard here. I was part of that debate, you know, stereotyping and the rise of the feminist agenda and so on.
Former BBC and ITV boss Michael Grade.
Yes, you could take all that, but it was just vaudeville, really. And it seemed to me the double standard was applied to Benny Hill and applied to Carry On. You know, Barbara Windsor and Kenneth Williams and Sid James leering and flashing their boobs all over Carry On was kind of revered as some kind, because it was the cinema, dear, you know.
Benny Hill wasn't the only mainstream artist still working in the 1980s, though. Morecambe and Wise were still the country's biggest comedy stars, and performers such as Cannon and Ball and Jimmy Cricket were making it big on TV after years in the live business. As Jimmy Cricket remembers, though, the landscape was changing.
In monetary terms, I was probably unlucky. And Bob Monkhouse told me this, none other than Bob Monkhouse, when I went to see him in the Talk of the North. He said, Jimmy, I feel sorry. You've made it, you and Cannon Ball, when these places are closing. Because Bob had been massive in the 70s when all, and Tommy Cooper, when there was cabaret clubs right round the country where you could do a complete week and get, like, twice night and Friday was the theatres. You'd do a week and they all used to get on the train and crew, Morecambe and Wise. Well, cabaret clubs. But that was starting to change then.
But there's much more to the 1980s than alternative comedy versus the mainstream. This was the decade that gave us Acorn Antiques from Victoria Wood's sketch show As Seen on TV, and possibly the most successful sitcom of all time, the mass appeal Only Fools and Horses.
Stick a pony in me pocket, I'll fetch the suitcase from the van.
I have this dream. You and I own this skyscraper office block on the South Bank. We're standing on a balcony in a penthouse suite with a couple of sorts. We're sipping red drinks, and above us on top of the skyscraper in 50 foot high neon lettering are the initials of Trotters Independent Traders. Good, isn't it, eh?
Terrific, Dill.
I think that dream of yours contains a subliminal message.
Yeah. You what?
A sort of subconscious truth. You see this skyscraper belonging to Trotters Independent Traders, right?
Yeah.
And on the roof are the company's initials, and you're standing on a penthouse balcony. Well, don't you see what the dream's trying to tell you? As you're standing on that balcony with your red drink, just above your head in 50-foot high neon lettering is the word tit.
Yeah, I mean, these were people that were in the area I lived. I worked as a very young kid in the market, and then when I was older, I worked in second-hand car trade, and it was filled with guys like Dell with their half-sovereign rings and wads of notes and gold necklaces.
Only Fools writer John Sullivan speaking in 2010.
They're all going to be successful, all going to be millionaires, and so I kind of just kept that theme going. But I wanted to write about it because nobody in the BBC or on TV was writing about this generation and the new speak, the new thinking. So I wrote Fools and Horses with all that, the new slang, the everything, the new attitude that came from the streets.
What's wrong?
No, nothing, nothing. No, I just worked out that everything could work out very, very cushy.
Only Fools and Horses built on the heightened realism which began with Hancock and Steptoe. Del Boy and Rodney's adventures were as funny as any of the comedy greats, and, like Steptoe, although never as dark, it tried to deal with real-life issues.
What we did on there, we kind of mirrored their lives. We all of us face death and family death and we marriage and birth, and we did it all. But in a sitcom, rather than in a soap, I think people lived kind of through that. They could follow them. And so with Dave and Nick, have always said to me, never be frightened where you want to go, just go and we'll do it. So it was a good sort of club to be in, where nobody was frightened of anything. They know there's going to a laugh's coming soon, so they'll sit back and let you do what you want, actually. And I did like doing that sort of thing, because I think it just made them more human.
Only Fools wasn't the only mainstream sitcom success. The stars of the smash hit 1970s sitcom The Good Life returned in popular new vehicles. Penelope Keith in To the Manor Born, Richard Briers in Ever Decreasing Circles, and Paul Eddington in Yes Minister.
Hello, Vic. Do you know Sir Humphrey Appleby, Vic Gould, no. Chief Whip?
You're a real pain in the arse, Jim, aren't you? The PM's going up the wall.
Really?
Hitting the roof. You can't go around making speeches like that.
I'm sorry, but...
In politics, you've got to learn how to say things with tact and finesse, you Burke. And when to say nothing at all.
Well, do you want to give thought to a draft letter of resignation, Minister? I mean, just in case, of course.
Can't we hush it up?
Hush it up?
Yes. Hush it up.
What do you mean, suppress it?
Yes, I suppose I do.
I see. You mean that within the framework of the guidelines about open government which you have laid down, you're suggesting that we should adopt a more flexible posture.
Am I?
Yes, Minister.
You're listening to A History of British Comedy on BBC Radio 2, presented by me, David Mitchell.
Hello.
Other successes included Rab C. Nesbitt and Keeping Up Appearances, the latter proving that traditional British stereotypes like the snobby, class-conscious social climber were still ripe with comic potential. Meanwhile, One Foot in the Grave was so culturally influential that grumpy old men are called Victor Meldrew characters to this day.
You'll soon be through those underpants again, I see.
I know, Jean. It's a mystery to me how he does it. Look! He wear out a suit of armour.
They don't seem to last 5 minutes on him, do they?
Here! You may as well use them to wipe your hands on!
Yes, thank you, ladies. I wonder if I could bring in the lady up the road walking her dog at this point. Excuse me, madam. We're asking everyone in the world what they think of Victor Meldrew's disturbing tendency to wear out a pair of Y fronts in 10 seconds flat. Yes, the Bishop of Durham. What's your point of view on this one, sir?
I don't think he slept very well last night.
As mainstream and alternative acts vied for supremacy, the BBC came up with a cunning plan. A series that managed to combine cutting-edge material with mainstream appeal.
No time to lose, eh?
My thoughts precisely. Yeah. The only question is who to choose as MP.
Tricky.
What we need is an utter unknown, yet someone over whom we have complete power. A man with no mind, with no ideas of his own.
One might almost say a man with no brain.
Well, any thoughts?
Yes, Your Highness.
Rang, my lord.
Meet the new Member of Parliament for Dummy on the Road.
But he's an absolute arsehead.
Precisely so. Our slogan shall be a rotten candidate for a rotten borough. Warwick, I want you to go back to your kitchen sink, you see, and prepare for government.
Blackadder ran for four series and several specials, and in its final episode was brave enough to push comedy into tragedy.
Company, one, pace forward.
Oh, there's a nasty splinter on that ladder, sir. A bloke could hurt himself on that.
Stand ready!
I have a plan, sir.
Really, Borick? A cunning and subtle one?
Yes, sir.
As cunning as a fox who's just been appointed Professor of Cunning at Oxford University?
Yes, sir.
On the signal, company will advance!
Well, I'm afraid it'll have to wait. Whatever it was, I'm sure it was better than my plan to get out of this by pretending to be mad. I mean, who would have noticed another madman round here? Good luck, everyone.
Tragic moments in Blackadder, social comment in Steptoe and Son, and human drama in Only Fools and Horses demonstrate that for a sitcom to be great, it needs to be dark as well as light. Unless it's as funny as Fawlty Towers, which breaks this rule like so many others. That's comedy for you. As the 1980s turned into the 90s, those radical alternative figures from the Comedy Store and comic strip turned gently into father and mother figures of the scene. It's a mainstream effect that has impacted on many cutting-edge comics, although never, of course, Spike Milligan.
Ooh! Like all things, comedy is a fashionable thing.
Dr. C.P. Lee.
Comedians get built up and then they fall down. I met Les Dawson, and he was bemoaning the fact that he felt that he'd been totally superseded by alternative comedians. In fact, he hadn't, but it was at a point where the BBC were dropping contracts left, right and centre. So were ITV as well. The older comedians were no longer looked upon as, I suppose, the hot new things, which indeed they weren't the hot new things anymore, and new comedians are coming up. But if you stick around long enough, and you take an example of that would be Bob Monkhouse, you're suddenly venerated again. And Les Dawson, if he hadn't died so tragically, would have, I'm sure, have undergone a massive renaissance.
Jennifer Saunders, so celebrated as a performer the decade before, was now the star and writer of a sitcom that would conquer the world.
OK, come on, Ed. Car's here. Let's go.
Oh, driving in?
Well, yeah, what do you think I should do? Fly? Gosh, that's not bad,
isn't it? Well, I just find it strange, that's all. I mean, I just can't understand how someone who can have been into absolutely everything for the past 20 years, I mean, not one trend has passed her by, yet somehow she's conveniently dodged ever having to take any exercise. I mean, that fad, that craze was missed by a mile. Mm.
Can I just explain about that for a second, darling? In the 60s, darling, we were too stoned to jog. In the 70s... we had platform shoes. And in the 80s, darling... what happened in the 80s? What was
brain
it?
Cells destroyed in the 60s. You know, she can't remember. The age of the punk.
Yes, punk, darling. We were too busy putting pins through our noses.
But you were too old to be a punk, weren't you?
Darling, I was a punk.
I know.
Oh!
Here's Jennifer Saunders on why Ab Fab was so popular.
It's kind of wish fulfillment. I think people would like to live like that. And I think... we're quite strict on ourselves nowadays and what we allow ourselves to do and what we're told we should be doing, you know. How many units of alcohol, how many units of fat we're allowed to consume and all this stuff. And I think people would actually kind of have more pleasure if they lived more like Adina and Patsy.
Jennifer Men were embracing their foibles as well. After years of political correctness, comedy was starting to behave badly again. Well, at least if you were a man. Men Behaving Badly producer Beryl Virtue.
Simon Nye and I did not set out to, you know, do the birth of laddism, but that's apparently what we did. I mean, they were extremely chauvinistic in a period where you were not supposed to be chauvinistic. And yet, the viewership was equal. Men and women watched it. So it obviously didn't upset any women. And that was because they were actually really likeable characters. And they were very harmless at the end of the day.
As we've said, rules of comedy are made to be broken. And one of the rules was that sitcoms needed a studio audience. Well, not necessarily. After all, horror films don't have a scream track. But there's a long history of egging on audience laughter. There were plants in the crowds at Shakespearean performances in the 16th century. They spurred on group reactions, including laughter and cheering. Centuries later, TV and radio producers went for the same effect by bringing a live audience in to watch shows being recorded.
It's a very strange thing to do shows for about 300 people, which are going to be shown to several million. And you are affected in your timing by the fact the audience is there.
Comedy writer David Nobbs.
I was very surprised to find that Leonard Rossiter was a huge fan of the studio audience, because he said, then you've got to be funny. And you learn your technique, because you've got to put the funny bit of the line at the end, because they'll laugh and your laugh will go through the rest of it. And you've got to do that without sounding as if you're artificial. It's quite a test, and it's very, very interesting.
Comedy written for a studio audience needs to have a certain structure, though. Beryl Virtue again.
There's almost a rhythm. You go, duh, duh, laugh, duh, duh, laugh, duh, duh, laugh. You always say, you know, in a rather boring fashion, got to have at least three good laughs per page sort of thing. Otherwise, it somehow doesn't work.
But when Carolina Hearn and Craig Cash created The Royal Family in 1998, they decided to do away with the studio audience altogether. They wanted to tell stories about people who just sat around chatting. The concept of realism in sitcom, started by Galton and Simpson with Hancock and Steptoe and Son, was taking another step forward.
This is Emma.
We're very pleased to meet you, Emma. I've heard a lot about you. Help yourself to the buffet. Can I get you a ham sandwich?
Oh, no, thank you. I'm a vegetarian.
Ooh. Can I do you a Dairily instead?
No, honestly, I'm fine, thank you.
She can have Dairily, can't she, Denise?
Yeah.
What is she?
She's a vegetarian, Nana.
Oh, you could have a bit of cheese, though. Have you got some cheese, Barbara? Oh, Emma, it's a shame for you.
If she doesn't want anything, she doesn't want any. Leave the girl alone.
She's all right.
Hey, that's a belting little car you've got, love. What does your dad drive?
Could you have some wafer-thin ham? Could she have wafer-thin ham, Barbara? No.
But was the royal family approach unprecedented? Here's Hancock's Half Hour from 1958.
Oh, look! It started raining.
That's all we wanted. You watch, it'll go dark in a minute. We'll have to switch the lights on. I think I'll go to bed.
You've only been up an hour.
That is, by the way, and nothing to do with it. I might just as well be in bed. There's nothing else to do. I wish I hadn't got up now. Your dinner wasn't worth getting up for, I'll tell you that for a start.
Oh, well, I don't know. I ate all mine.
That is neither here nor there. You also ate Bill's and Sid's and mine. I thought my mother was a bad cook, but at least her gravy used to move about.
In stand-up comedy, the delivery of a message became less important in the 1990s than it had been in the 80s. In the proliferation of live clubs, anyone was still encouraged to get up and have a go. But alongside that punk spirit, comedy was being called the new rock and roll. But Performers like Newman and Baddiel, and later Lee Evans, would make the stadium gig commonplace. Sweeping politics away with the surreal approach came Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer, who made an art out of silliness, much like Michael Bentine's It's a Square World or Spike Milligan's Q series had in the past. As the millennium turned, TV shows like The League of Gentlemen and Little Britain mixed novelty with nostalgia, reflecting the 1970s character-based sketch show style of Dick Emery, whilst delivering material that would never have made it past Bill Cotton.
Florence, my dear, remember, we are two ladies taking afternoon tea. Yes, Emily. I know this is all very new to you, but the trick is not to draw attention to yourself. Two ladies for tea, please.
Yes, of course. This way.
Ladies first.
I am also a lady.
Oh, yes.
Here we are.
Florence, do take a seat.
No, after you, Emily.
Florence, I insist.
No, Emily, please.
We're both ladies. Who sits first?
Sit down.
Okey cokey, pig in a pokey.
Hello, Paulie.
First up, I want us all to close our eyes and just listen. Can you hear that? That is the sound of industry. The sound of men with jobs going to work. To them, it's a joyous sound, a song of hope and dignity. But to others, that sound is just a din, a daily reminder of how worthless and pathetic they are. Good morning, job seekers. My name's Pauline, and you've all been on the dole too long. Hey, Mickey, where are you going?
Toilet.
No, you're not. I need you for this exercise. Come and stand next to me.
I want to go to the toilet.
Well, you're not allowed. So, job seekers, first of all, I want us to really stretch our imaginations and pretend that Mickey here's got an interview for a job. It's all right, Mickey, we're only playing. But the thing is, I've got an interview for the same job. So, Ross, take a good look at me.
Do I have to?
Yes. And take a good look at Mickey. What have I got that Mickey hasn't got?
A moustache.
Meanwhile, continuing in the realistic fly-on-the-wall style of the royal family, came a groundbreaking comic mockumentary from Ricky Gervais.
People see me and they see the suit and they go, you're not fooling anyone. They know I'm rock and roll through and through. But you know that old thing, live fast, die young. Not my way. Live fast, sure, live too bloody fast sometimes. But die young, die old.
Since the development of digital TV and radio, our comedy choices have mushroomed. BBC Three was launched in 2003 with a remit of appealing to a younger audience. Shows like The Mighty Boosh and Two Pints of Lager and a Packet of Crisps did just that. But it was a traditional tale of romance that proved the bigger hit. The award-winning Gavin and Stacey soon moved to BBC One, and its final episode pulled in an audience of 9 million. With the growth of subscription TV, organisations such as Sky and, well, actually it is just Sky, are now investing in homegrown comedy talent, giving the terrestrial channels a run for their money, with traditional comedies such as Trolleyed or Stella. In the main, though, commissioners seem to target specific audiences now, whether it's the young people who flock to experimental material on Channel 4 or the middle-aged punters who still watch repeats of Dad's Army in their millions.
It's my belief in this modern day and age that television now narrowcasts.
Showbiz agent Laurie Mansfield.
And it aims its comedy at specific audiences. It can do that by the number of channels that it has. And it aims its comedy to suit certain people. Whereas up until the 80s, probably, television comedy, radio comedy had to reach as broad an audience as it was possible to reach. I think now it doesn't have to do that. In many ways, that's a good thing because you know exactly who you're aiming at, and frankly, you don't offend people because they won't be watching the people who would be offended. You're not aiming this and saying, we're coming into your front room. We're saying, we're going to give you the comedy that you want to have. And in that respect, it's like music. If you want to listen to Andy Williams, you can go listen to Andy. You can find a radio station that will play that. And if you want to listen to hip-hop or if you want to listen to rap, you can find that as well. And that's what television does in comedy today. And I think that's right.
My great contention is there's no such thing as a dem.
you're writing for them. They will like this. I don't think that's ever worked 100%, ever.
Barry Cryer.
You've just got to do what you want to do. But now there's an obsession. You know, there was the obsession with youth. We must aim for the young. And then as time went on with technology and phones and kids going out to clubs and everything, they were the very ones who weren't sitting at home watching television. It was the middle and older lot who were watching television who suddenly felt cut off because they were aiming at a younger audience and at this audience and that audience. The really good shows, people know good stuff when they see it. And young people and older people will like something really good. But what did break up was, of course, the family sitting around and watching something.
But is comedy just another victim of a marketing culture that likes tidy demographics to aim its wares at? And if so, what effect will our ageing population have on the development of comedy in the future?
Now comedy is really big business.
Alan Davis.
And there are lots of comedians now who have made a huge amount of money. And at the time that I started, there weren't any of those. There weren't any not doing the kind of stuff we were doing. You know, the most successful people were maybe on Channel 4 on Friday night. There was nobody in the mainstream. So there's been a huge shift. The comedy that started on the alternative circuit in the 80s has now perhaps travelled almost full circle. And what remains is a fairly safe middle ground. But it has been through the rigorous checking of political correctness that was started in the 80s.
The tough thing in comedy nowadays is finding subjects that people can identify with whilst at the same time not retreading ground other comedians have already trod.
Comedian Ed Byrne.
And that's a very tricky thing to do, because you can either go off on the surreal route, but even that's, you know, in danger of being done to death. Or, you talk about things that are so obscure and so niche that you don't end up playing to very many people. Or, you know, you're in danger if you talk about things, though, that are too general, that everyone can relate to, then you're in danger of doing stuff that people have just heard before. So I think that's the tricky thing, is just finding what people can relate to that people haven't already spoken about.
Where the new alternative is, where the fringe is quite difficult to find, but it will be there. And there have been people, I think, over recent years who are what you might call fringe of the fringe. I think in particular of Simon Munnery, or I think Daniel Kitson to an extent, or people who just operate slightly outside, and they're generally the ones, and the ones who are on the outside, who are changing things slightly or pushing in a different direction, are the ones who appear to have no monetary ambitions. Or for whom the consolation of wealth is no consolation. And they consider themselves artists, and what they see is perfect their art. They can't, because nothing they do ever satisfies them, so they're driven by their own self-loathing. And these people are quite important, and not just important in comedy, they're important in all art forms, you know.
But while TV might feel the need to plan and commission its comedy on the basis of target audience and age range, stand-up comics like Peter Kay and Michael McIntyre are playing to mass stadium audiences, and their material is accessible to all. Let's contrast two styles of stand-up comedy that still pack them in night after night. After years of working the clubs and holiday camps, Jimmy Cricket hit the big time in the 1980s. TV and radio series followed, and he's still working to this day.
I'm a bit of a crusader for mainstream, because I go out and I see Tom O'Connor lift the roof off without doing anything untoward, and Cannon and Ball, this great, beautiful double act, which, you know, fabulous. And I see these comedians and I think they should be seen more. They should be on more exposure, because when you go into an audience, they've got the stagecraft, they've got the talent, and they've got the humour. So I do. And the fact that we've all learned to live, and we brought up a family in the 80s, but we're still out there.
All clear, good. I can read the letter from my mammy. Dear Jimmy, I went with your father last Sunday to the christening of your cousin Walter and his wife Rita's new baby. Unfortunately, the priest tripped. He's now called Walter Oops Cricket.
Jimmy Cricket makes no apologies for his mainstream and traditional approach, but his daughter, Katie Mulgrew, is also a stand-up comedian.
I think obviously it was an influence, you being a stand-up, but working behind a bar at that comedy club was definitely another one of me seeing the stand-ups and thinking, gosh, I love this. I'd really like to sort of give it a whirl, give it a go.
Yeah.
It's a different world, I suppose, but I don't think I'm a very good actress anyway, so I don't think I could do character comedy as such. There are brilliant character comedians still out there. It's a very specific talent, I think, to create that character and to sort of live by that character, you know, and write very specific for that. I mean, you know, Steve Coogan's amazing at character comedy. It's a very specific thing. I don't think I ever thought I was going to do that. And also, I never, you know, I don't use your name. I don't ever.
No, of course not. And that's just very commendable.
But I'm much more conversational and I do a lot of comparing as well, so.
You're a tremendous ad libber. You fly by the seat of your pants. That's why I'm married, but my daughter. I mean, I live here, but I've got a structure. I'll try and put new stuff in. Bar Katie can just go take the room and whatever's happening, she will be, which is incredibly brave, courageous, you know.
Yeah, some say courageous, some say write some jokes.
And so, after 100 years of development, our comedy is a disparate and diverse medium, but one that still thrives on a combination of predictability and surprise.
Now, I think the thick of it, that's pushing boundaries with Arnando Annucci, who's terribly clever, but he's also very knowledgeable about what he's writing about. And sometimes you seemingly go backwards. I mean, a big hit is Mrs. Brown's Boys. Some people think that's really old-fashioned. What is it doing there? I'm one of the people. Those people, I laugh and laugh. You're never going to get 100% of everything, of everybody loving one thing, unless you're extremely bland, and then a lot of people won't bother with it.
I think the enormous difference between the comedy world of today and what we lived with is the sheer saturation of comedy there is today.
Comedy writer and presenter Dennis Norden.
You've got it on the internet, there's YouTube, there's every kind of comedy program, there's comedy clubs. Now, you can compare it to two things, sex and chicken. See, when we started, chicken was a luxury. You went to a restaurant, chicken cost more than oysters. And if I may stretch the analogy a little, sex. There was no such thing as casual sex. There's casual comedy now, you see. And there is a case for saying that the superfluity of it in some cases makes you satiated before you would have been at an earlier time. Now, that is, to me, is the big difference. The fact that everywhere you look, there is a comedy supply.
And what is interesting to me now is that I've been talking about programs of a long while ago, and they're all back. You know, you've got Steptoe and Son being shown again, Hancock being shown again, all these new audiences. I mean, my daughters didn't know them, you know, hadn't seen their material. Dad's Army, which I'm sure I can say some of the scripts, and still I laugh, you know. It just shows you that when you get it right, it can go on and on and on.
Well, at the risk of sounding like a carry-on character, that's about the size of it. We were going to try and sum up the essence of our national comedy in a few well-chosen words. But instead, we're going to let these people do it for us. Here's to the next 100 years of British comedy. After that, let's call it a day. I mean, a joke's a joke.
I was dumb messing about.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while.
Hello, Fawlty Towers.
In this world where we live, there should be more happiness.
The day war broke out, my missus looked at me and she said,
Can I do your nails, sir?
Make me happy through the years.
I'm free.
What a silly Billy.
I heard that. Pardon.
Any tears.
You dirty old man.
Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above.
They all laughed when I said I was going to become a comedian. Well, they're not laughing now.
Stupid boy.
Ooh. In your smile, bring me laughter.
Four candles.
Well, there you are, four candles.
No, four candles. Candles for forks.
And there's more.
I have been sick, but I'm all right now.
No, I mean, I wouldn't care, but she knows, you know.
Turned out nice again, hasn't it?
Lovely jubbly, isn't it?
Let your arms be as warm.
I don't believe it.
What a performance.
Basil.
A pint? That's very nearly an armful.
It's Alan in the market.
Oh, Ron. I'm only bold.
Hello.
George.
Don't do that.
You've been listening to Radio 2's History of British Comedy, presented by David Mitchell, who is me. It was written and produced by Phil Collinge, and the executive producer was Ashley Byrne. It was a Made in Manchester production for BBC Radio 2.
You've all done very well.